John 1, 1 through 18. In the beginning was the Word, and the Word was with God, and the Word was God. He was in the beginning with God. All things were made through him, and without him nothing was made that was made. In him was life, and the life was the light of men, and the light shines in the darkness, and the darkness did not comprehend it. There was a man sent from God whose name was John. This man came for a witness to bear witness of the light that all through him might believe. He was not that light, but was sent to bear witness of that light. That was the true light, which gives light to every man coming into the world. He was in the world, and the world was made through him, and the world did not know him. He came to his own, and his own did not receive him. But as many as received him, to them he gave the right to become children of God, to those who believe in his name, who were born not of blood, nor of the will of the flesh, nor the will of man, but of God. And the Word became flesh and dwelt among us, and we beheld his glory, the glory as of the only begotten of the Father, full of grace and truth. John bore witness of him and cried out, saying, "This was he of whom I said, 'He who comes after me is preferred before me, for he was before me.' And of his fullness we have all received, and grace for grace. For the law was given through Moses, but grace and truth came through Jesus Christ. No one has seen God at any time. The only begotten Son, who is in the bosom of the Father, he has declared him." That is John chapter 1, verses 1 through 18, which is the prologue, the introduction to the Gospel of John and the subject of this sermon, a sermon which was extremely difficult to prepare because, as you can see, there is so much there. It is so weighty, so rich. What would one sermon on it be about? It's sort of like a cook thrust into the ideal grocery store. Meat, dairy, pasta, vegetables, the finest ingredients, everything of the highest quality. The cook is ushered in and told to select the ingredients for a meal. Well, in one sense, that's easy because anything you pick is wonderful. It'd be a perfect ingredient. But you have to decide which meal you are going to cook. Out of the 1,000 wonderful meals you could prepare, which one will you actually prepare? Got to narrow it down. Pass by the wonderful this and ignore the luscious that, because perfect as they are, they don't fit into the one meal you're preparing. Last week we introduced the Gospel of John. I chose the interrogative question framework, what, who, what, when, where, how, why, and offered this summary statement. Around 90 AD in Ephesus, the Apostle John wrote an elegant gospel to promote belief in Jesus. Told you how much I like that statement, and particularly the word elegant. How fittingly it describes John's gospel, because I'm not employing it in the sense of high class, but in its most profound sense. Dignified gracefulness, restrained beauty, precision, neatness and simplicity. We talked about how basic and how profound John is. He uses a very simple vocabulary, which I'll illustrate by a measurement it will take a moment to explain. Every language has basic words and complex words. The basic words are more common, we use them a lot, the complex words less common. For example, in English, door is a pretty basic word. Gets used a lot. Xenobiotic is not. You probably have never uttered that word in your life. So, taking the Greek New Testament as a whole and making the cutoff at 50 occurrences, that is to say, if a word occurs 50 or more times in the Greek New Testament, we'll call it common. And if it occurs less than 50 times, we'll call it uncommon. Using that measurement, I have a resource that lists all the uncommon words in the New Testament, that is, the words that occur less than 50 times, lists them by book, chapter, and verse. In that resource, it takes 23 pages to list the uncommon words in the Gospel of Matthew. It takes 20 pages to list the uncommon words in Mark, and 31 pages to list the uncommon words in Luke. The uncommon words in John require only 12 pages. That's one way to measure the simplicity of his vocabulary. He doesn't use big words, he doesn't use fancy words, but with the simplest words, the commonest words, he tells us the profoundest things, as we can see in his opening words. 100 sermons would not exhaust them. But since we're only doing one, I thought it best to do, in terms of the earlier example, the meal I decided to prepare is a summary, an overview, a big picture statement of what's communicated in John 1, 1 through 18, which I will phrase this way. God became man to explain himself to us. The eternal creator, higher than the highest heaven God, plunged into the world, assumed humanity, became man on a mission from God to explain himself to us. God became man to explain himself to us. Now, I'm going to expand that just a little bit, label in broad terms the things he explained, because from his perspective, there's a couple of things we needed to know. In general terms, two things. One is about creation, and the other is about redemption. So my post-it note summary of John 1, 1 through 18 is, God became man to explain himself to us, in particular, as creator and redeemer. Now, I'm going to read the text again, and with that summary in mind, you'll see, though imperfect, it gets us in the ballpark, kind of puts a fence around it. God became man to explain himself to us, in particular, as creator and redeemer. Here again is John 1, 1 through 18. In the beginning was the Word, and the Word was with God, and the Word was God. He was in the beginning with God. All things were made through him, and without him nothing was made that was made. In him was life, and the life was the light of men. And the light shines in the darkness, and the darkness did not comprehend it. There was a man sent from God whose name was John. This man came for a witness, to bear witness of the light, that all through him might believe. He was not that light, but was sent to bear witness of that light. That was the true light, which gives light to every man coming into the world. He was in the world, and the world was made through him, and the world did not know him. He came to his own, and his own did not receive him. But as many as received him, to them he gave the right to become children of God. To those who believe in his name, who were born not of blood, nor of the will of the flesh, nor the will of man, but of God. And the Word became flesh and dwelt among us. And we beheld his glory, the glory as of the only begotten of the Father, full of grace and truth. John bore witness of him and cried out, saying, "This was he of whom I said, 'He who comes after me is preferred before me, for he was before me.' And of his fullness we have all received, and grace for grace, for the law was given through Moses. But grace and truth came through Jesus Christ. No one has seen God at any time. The only begotten Son, who is in the bosom of the Father, he has declared him." Now, I will highlight three verses. The first, showing he is God, that's verse 1. The second, showing that he became man, that's verse 14. And the third, showing he did it to explain himself, that is verse 18. So, verse 1, in the beginning was the Word, and the Word was with God, and the Word was God. Now, of course, God is God, that's not news. The news in John 1:1 is that the Word was not only with God in the beginning, but that the Word was God. Yes, I read that right. Yes, you heard it right. No, it's not a misprint. The Word was with God, and the Word was God. That is exactly what it says. Keeping that in mind, drop down to verse 14, which tells us, "And the Word became flesh and dwelt among us, and we beheld his glory, the glory as of the only begotten of the Father, full of grace and truth." For our immediate purpose, the only thing that concerns us is the first part of the first phrase, "And the Word became flesh." Verse 1, the Word was God. Verse 14, the Word became flesh. God became man. That's what the Word became flesh means. Now, I know he dwelt among us and we beheld his glory, and there's a lot of stuff going on, but the main plot, the key assertion, is that God became man. Verse 1, the Word was God. Verse 14, the Word became flesh. Now, completing our summary statement, verse 18, no one has seen God at any time. The only begotten Son who is in the bosom of the Father, he has declared him. Again, a lot going on, but this time we're just looking at the last phrase. He has declared him. He, the only begotten Son, the Word who became flesh, has declared him, the Father, whom no one has seen at any time. God became man to explain himself to us. The Word became flesh to declare the Father. Declared is the key word there in verse 18. The NIV and ESV translations render that phrase as "he has made him known." The New American Standard has "he has explained him." We'll go into it at length. Right now, we're just closing the loop on the simple summary. God became man to explain himself to us. Verse 1, the Word was God. Verse 14, the Word became flesh. Verse 18, he, the Word, has declared him. In the terms of the text, the Word became flesh to declare him. As I've stated it, God became man to explain himself to us. So with the central message, the backbone in view, we're going to retrace our steps, folding in the things he declared. Creator, Redeemer. They're huge. They are gigantic. In any other context, either one of them would dominate the stage, steal the show. But John is so cosmic, so comprehensive, that creation and redemption are co-stars. They don't merit top billing. That's reserved for incarnation. God becoming man. That's the wowzer. Because by that means we recognize our Creator. Through that means he becomes our Redeemer. But it is that means, incarnation, that's the point of his introduction. Verse 1 is a transparent declaration that the Word, identified as Jesus Christ, the only begotten Son, a few verses later, a transparent declaration that he, the Word, was God. In the beginning was the Word, and the Word was with God, and the Word was God. Verse 3 is a transparent declaration that he is the Creator. All things were made through him, and without him nothing was made that was made. It's also an interesting example of John's style. Simple words doing a relatively simple thing. He declares the positive, all things were made through him, and then denies the negative. Without him, nothing was made that was made. And there's the irony, or the joke, because what he says couldn't be clearer. He just stated it forwards and backwards. It's as clear as it could be. Yet it's stunning. Brings us to the edge of a vast precipice. Welcome to John. Crystal clear and dizzyingly deep. Verses 4 and 5 begin the redemption theme. In him was life, and the life was the light of men, and the light shines in the darkness, and the darkness did not comprehend it. Verse 1, God. Verse 3, Creator. Verses 4 and 5, Redeemer. Now I'm going to cite a couple of Old Testament passages that are background for John's prologue. They're information he assumes his readers have in mind. And of course, his original readers did have it in mind. But at this remove of language, culture, and time, we understandably need some hints and helps to get it. Though even at this remove, there's a chance we may catch one of them, because John makes it so screamingly obvious. Literally, the first thing he says, in the beginning. Does that ring a bell? Ever heard that one before? Even 2,000 years later, this may be the most easily recognizable phrase in the world. They're the opening words of the book of Genesis, the opening words of the Bible. And by quoting them, John obviously wants that beginning in our minds as he tells us about his beginning. So let's refresh ourselves on the opening words of the Bible. In the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth. The earth was without form and void, and darkness was on the face of the deep, and the Spirit of God was hovering over the face of the waters. Then God said, "Let there be light," and there was light. And God saw the light, that it was good, and God divided the light from the darkness. God called the light day, and the darkness he called night. So the evening and the morning were the first day. Thus begins the account of creation, the first step of which is the creation of light, separating from, pushing back against, darkness. Compare John 1, 3 through 5. All things were made through him, and without him nothing was made. In him was life, and the life was the light of men. And the light shines in the darkness, and the darkness did not comprehend it. Do you hear the echo? Can you feel the resonance? It is not a coincidence. It's very much on purpose. Don't worry about bringing the meaning sharply into focus. Just keep it in mind, because remember, the newsflash in John 1 is not that God is the creator. That's a given. The newsflash from John 1 is that the Word, who was with God and was God in the beginning, the newsflash is that he's the creator. All things were made through him. Without him, nothing was made that was made. There is a very simple connection between John 1 and Genesis 1, though it may not be obvious to us. The reason we may not see it has to do with the way we're prone to think. Modern Western tendency to abstraction. In this case, about the Trinity. We hear the Word was with God and the Word was God, and our minds start spinning off in one direction or another. The biblical connection is clear and simple, maybe too clear, perhaps too simple for us. The newsflash from John 1 is that the Word is God, is the Creator. Back in Genesis, we see God. In the beginning, God created. The Spirit is even mentioned. He's there hovering over the face of the waters. But what about the Word, through whom all things were made? He's there at every step. Just listen. In the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth was without form and void, and darkness was on the face of the deep, and the Spirit of God was hovering over the face of the waters. Then God said, "Let there be light," and there was light, and God saw the light, that it was good. God divided the light from the darkness. God called the light day, and the darkness he called night. So the evening and the morning were the first day. That's Genesis 1, 1 through 5, takes us through the first day. The next verse, Genesis 1, 6, reads, "Then God said, let there be a firmament in the midst of the waters, and let it divide the waters from the waters." Takes us through day 2 to verse 9, beginning of day 3. "Then God said, let the waters under the heaven be gathered together into one place," etc., etc. Every day, every step, every act is because God said. He used his words. Or more precisely, he used his word. Psalm 33:6, by the word of the Lord, the heavens were made. Hebrews 11:3, by faith we understand that the worlds were formed by the word of God. I am not saying the transparent connection between God said and the word provides anything like a thorough explanation of the triunity of God. Those are deep waters, Watson. I am saying it's the clear, direct biblical connection, and if you get sidetracked in pursuit of an integrated rational analysis, you will miss the clear, direct biblical flow. Because John's not done yet. He's going somewhere. Remember, creation is a sub-point in John 1. The main point is incarnation, because the word, that one who was God with God in the beginning, through whom all things were made, that word became flesh. The word became flesh and dwelt among us, and we beheld his glory, the glory as of the only begotten of the Father, full of grace and truth. Just like everywhere else, there's a lot going on, but the word became flesh. That's the money quote, the mind blower, the jaw dropper, the incarnation. But just as John assumes his readers had the background of Genesis 1, providing some kind of framework for the word was God bombshell, so he assumes they have a background for the word becoming flesh. Some picture of God visibly dwelling in the midst of his people. The key phrase for that is dwelt among us and we beheld his glory. In its own way, that is as obvious as in the beginning. But due to time and language differences, we definitely needed help to get this one. So we'll go back to the Old Testament and talk about the other key reference theme John assumes his readers know, and I'll approach it this way. You probably know something about the temple of God in Jerusalem, the house of the Lord, sacrificial altar, holy of holies, showbread, incense, all of that was in the temple. But before they took Jerusalem, before they built the temple, they had the tabernacle. And the tabernacle housed all of that stuff, but it was portable. It was movable. It was a tent. A large portion of the book of Exodus tells about, conveys the instructions for making that tent. And the last chapter of Exodus, chapter 40, tells about the completion and inhabitation of that tent, because when it was set up, God came to dwell in it. The visible, tangible presence of God, aka the glory of God, right there in and above the tabernacle, the tent. And that tent was right in the middle of their camp. In fact, their camp was arranged around it. This is the time of the Exodus. And, you know, it's where they go to Mount Sinai and get the Ten Commandments, and then they're led. They're right to the edge of the Promised Land, but they fail to go in. So as punishment, they get sent, in essence, on a 40-year camping trip. About 2 million people schlepping through the wilderness for 40 years. Involves some serious logistics. The visible presence of God above the tabernacle was their pole star, the means by which they oriented themselves moving and camping. Access to the tabernacle itself was limited, just Moses, Aaron, and his sons. The people weren't going into the tabernacle, but every one of them could see the glory of God above the tabernacle. The particular passage we're going to read is the conclusion of the book of Exodus. They were still at Sinai, but they were getting ready to leave, and one of the reasons they were ready to leave was because the tabernacle had been completed and inhabited by God, which is what this passage describes, Exodus 40, 34 through 38. Then the cloud covered the tabernacle of meeting, and the glory of the Lord filled the tabernacle, and Moses was not able to enter the tabernacle of meeting because the cloud rested above it, and the glory of the Lord filled it. Whenever the cloud was taken up from above the tabernacle, the children of Israel would go onward in all their journeys. But if the cloud was not taken up, then they did not journey till the day that it was taken up. For the cloud of the Lord was above the tabernacle by day, and the fire was over it by night, in the sight of all the house of Israel throughout all their journeys. You go, gee whiz, Chris, that's fascinating. What does it have to do with John 1 and the incarnation? Good question. The tabernacle was movable. It was a tent. The Hebrew word for it is mishkan. It occurs 129 times in the Old Testament, the vast majority of them referring to the tabernacle, that tent, though occasionally it just means a tent or dwelling. So the Hebrew is mishkan. The Greek word for tent is skene. When the Hebrew Old Testament was translated into Greek, 3rd century B.C., they translated mishkan with skene. Okay? They translated the Hebrew word for tent with the Greek word for tent. Good idea. Okay. The Greek New Testament follows the Greek Old Testament, referring to the tabernacle as the skene. It's the tent. So, the special place where God dwelt visibly in the midst of his people was a tent, in Hebrew mishkan, in Greek skene. You know how you can make a verb out of a noun? Like flag. Flag is a thing. But I can flag somebody down, or flag this, or flag that. It's basically a noun, but it can be used as a verb. When I was growing up, we did that with sky. Sky. Made it into a verb, meaning to jump high. Tended to be applied to the realm of basketball. Oh, we tried the sky. I could sky somewhat. Dr. J... he could sky. He skied above them all. Well, I tell you that to tell you this. When John 1:14 says the word became flesh and dwelt among us, the word translated dwelt there is skene, the Greek word for tent, the New Testament word for the tabernacle, but in an unusual form, it's used as a verb. The way we employed sky as a verb, John uses tent as a verb. In John 1:14, one of the uncommon words he used, he's the only New Testament author to do it. Some specialty translations bring this out. F.F. Bruce, a scholar I pay a lot of attention to, translates it as, "The word became flesh and pitched his tabernacle among us." The Amplified Bible has, "The word became flesh and tabernacled, fixed his tent of flesh among us." Not very pretty, but it makes the point. For John's original readers, that word, skene, formed as a verb, would have brought to mind God's presence in the tabernacle just as surely and just as clearly as "in the beginning" brings to mind God's presence at creation. The word became flesh and skenade, tabernacled, dwelt among us, and we beheld his glory. The cloud of the Lord was above the tabernacle by day, and the fire was over it by night in the sight of all the house of Israel. That must have been awesome to see God's glory in that way. But it didn't get them any closer to God. Only Moses could meet with God. But when the word became flesh and tabernacled among us, we beheld his glory up close and personal. in a way we can understand, which is why the Word became flesh, why God became man, to explain himself to us. So in conclusion, we'll zero in on the word declared in verse 18, much like we zeroed in on dwelt in verse 14. Now John 1:18, no one has seen God at any time, the only begotten God who is in the bosom of the Father, he has declared him. I know there are some significant differences between translations in verse 18. I'm not going to address them because it would take too much time. I do want to show you those differences don't make any difference for the point I'm making, which is in the last phrase. I'm using the New King James, which reads, he has declared him. The New American Standard reads, he has explained him. The NIV reads, he has made him known. That's the point. The Word became flesh to declare, to explain, to make him known. Who? God the Father, whom no one has seen at any time. The only begotten Son, who's been in his bosom from the beginning, became flesh to declare him, to explain him, to make him known. The word translated, declare, there, is the Greek verb exegēsthai. And the funny thing about that word, exegēsthai, is it is what I am doing right now. Literally, actually, as I'm speaking. This word comes straight into English. The verb is exegēsthai. The Greek noun is exegesis. Straight into English. Exegesis. Greek exegesis. English exegesis. It's unusual for a word to hop languages that intact, but there it is. It's a compound word in Greek, a combination of hegesthai, to lead, and the prefix ek, out. Stick them together, you get exegesthai, to lead out. And the idea is to lead the meaning out, to explain, to reveal, to describe. When you exegete, you lead the meaning out. You unpack it. You explain it. This is an exegetical sermon. We're looking at the text of John 1:1-18, and I'm declaring, revealing, explaining it to you. If you're familiar with the biblical lingo, you know the opposite of exegesis. It's eisegesis. Topical's different, but exegesis, bringing the meaning out of, eisegesis, that's reading the meaning into. It's making the Bible say what you want it to say. Yes. Big no-no, happens all the time. Right. Well, the point here is that the Word, the only begotten Son, Jesus Christ, has exegeted God. He's revealed him. He's explained him. He's made him known by becoming flesh and dwelling among us. The problem is, Most High God, holy, 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 he's been trying to communicate with us since the fall. But we just haven't connected. And the problem's not on his end. It's on ours. He could have bailed 100 times, but he didn't. He kept at it until he broke through. But in order to break through, he had to come all the way down to our level. The Word, who in the beginning was God with God, through whom all things were made, he became flesh. He incarnated. He became one of us. He walked in our shoes, sweated our sweat. He bled our blood and shed our tears. And oh, by the way, bore our sin and died our death so that we could all get back together as one big happy family. Verse 12, as many as received him, to them he gave the right to become children of God. I'm standing before you trying to exegete John 1:1-18. It's huge. And I and you are very small. We have barely begun. There is so much here we haven't touched on. How about verse 17? For the law was given through Moses, but grace and truth came through Jesus Christ. I haven't said a word about that. If you've got another hour, I could begin to exegete it. I just quoted verse 12. As many as received him, to them he gave the right to become children of God. That's the gospel Dick was talking about. A little bit to unpack there, you think? But it's real simple. Ultimately, God does the work. I have the need. He does the work. I believe in him. To as many as received him, it says. You have to receive Christ. To as many as believed in his name. It's faith, not works. But you know what that gets you? The right to become children of God. Can you believe it? I've got the right. Glory. And we're not even talking about it. If you got another 2 hours, we could get started on that. In the beginning was the Word, and the Word was with God, and the Word was God. The mystery of the Trinity. We're going to have to pull an all-nighter to get started on that. I told you up front last week, it's the most amazing book that was ever written. What I've tried to do in this one message on John's introduction to his gospel, chapter 1, verses 1 through 18, the one meal I've tried to serve you is the main point, the big picture, which is the Word became flesh to declare the Father to us. God became man to explain himself to us. You want to know what God is like? Look at Jesus. You want to know what God says? Listen to Jesus. You want to know what God would do? Watch Jesus. In chapter 14, one of the disciples, Philip, is going to say to Jesus, Lord, show us the Father, and it is sufficient for us. And Jesus will reply, have I been with you so long, and yet you have not known me, Philip? He who has seen me has seen the Father. Let's pray. Lord, we are out of our leagues and out of our depth and over our heads. You're there in the beginning with God, our God, Creator. Lord, we understand, we don't understand, but we get the main thing. We know you're God, we know you became one of us, and we know you did that to communicate with us, and we know you did it to save us because you love us. Lord, as we go from here this day, and Lord, as we are privileged to gaze at you, to behold your glory through the Gospel of John in this study, would you open our eyes so that we can see you more clearly, appreciate what you have done for us, and Lord, may that warm our hearts so that we'll pass that along for others, because you are the true light that gives light to everyone coming into the world. We thank you and we praise you, Jesus. Amen.